It's nearly 3 o'clock, and you're listening to K2FM. I'm Ann Fuller, your host. Today on Juno Afternoon, we'll get an update on Theater in the Rough's presentation of The Ladies of the Camellias with guest Erin Elmore. We'll talk with Shasha Higby about preparing for wearable art. We'll learn about this week's Wildlife Wednesday presentation with nature artist Kathy Hawker. We'll get the details about high school hockey, and we'll highlight the Juno Douglas City Museum's annual meeting and the presentation by Richard Carstensen. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more. Wednesday, today on KTFM. It's snow and rain diminishing in the afternoon, mostly cloudy tonight. Rain Thursday with a snow level around 1,000 feet.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Obama met with a dozen tribal leaders Tuesday at the White House to discuss job creation and economic development. The meeting was among tribal leader events this week in Washington. Representatives from tribes across the country are hearing from the Obama administration today at the Department of the Interior. The morning session included comments by Interior Secretary Sally Jewell. Jewell also chairs the White House Council on Native American Affairs. She says the administration wants to continue to coordinate with tribes to address issues.
I know from growing up in this country that the federal government does not have a proud legacy with tribes. Injustice can't be reversed overnight, but I'm proud of this president for stepping up and recognizing that it exists, and I pledge that I'm going to work alongside you and the president and my colleagues to continue to make important progress, as I think you have seen happen over the course of the last 5 years.
Secretaries of the Departments of Health, Veterans, Transportation, Energy, and Justice addressed the leaders. There was also a video presentation about Robert F. Kennedy. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Attorney General Kennedy's speech to the National Congress of American Indians. It was delivered in Bismarck, North Dakota. The afternoon sessions include speakers on the environment, labor, and agriculture. There's also a listening session for tribes. The White House Tribal Nations Conference will conclude with remarks from the president. Among those invited to the White House conference is the CEO of a Native American business based on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation. Jim Kent has more.
Carlene Hunter is CEO of Native American Natural Foods, located in Kyle. The company is best known for its Tonka Bar, a natural food product based on a traditional Lakota recipe of buffalo and fruit. She says that given the opportunity, she'd like the chance to speak to the president herself.
I would like to talk about how the economy is hitting everyone across the board. When you get to Indian country, it's exemplified. We're in some of the most economically depressed areas, and the services are minimal at best.
Carlene Hunter adds that the sequestration and government shutdown made an already bad situation in Indian country worse. She'd like to know what the president plans to do in order to improve conditions in tribal areas. On a lighter note, Hunter says she's already sent Tonka Bars to the White House, but if she has the chance, she'll personally hand one to President Obama. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
A tribal house in the former location of Alaska's Hunaklinkets will go out to bid this winter. It's part of an effort to restore Native traditions to a national park and preserve. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from Juneau.
Glacier Bay was the traditional home of four clans of the Tlingits, Southeast Alaska's largest Native group. Then the ice that gives the bay its western name started advancing. The people moved and built new villages. Huna, about 30 miles to the southeast, is the largest. The ice receded, but the bay became a national park and preserve, blocking resettlement. Now, the Park Service is working with Huna leaders to build a tribal house for traditional ceremonies as well as tourist visits. Gordon Greenwald designed a 16-by-30-foot wooden screen depicting the history of the area. He spoke at a recent clan conference in Juneau.
I had many visits from ancestors through the nights, so there were many additions and deletions from this as I went along, and I always joked with my assistants that every now and then they would knock on my door in the middle of the night and say, "Young man, you thought you knew what you were doing. No, you don't. You need to change this."
The construction contract for the $4 million project will go out to bid this winter. It should be completed by mid-2016. For National Native News, this is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
In November 1871, the San Carlos Apache Reservation was established by executive order. Located in southeastern Arizona, the reservation spans three counties with a landscape that ranges from alpine meadows to desert. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past three. You're listening to K2, and this is Juno Afternoon. My name's Ann Fuller, and I'm in the studio here with Theater in the Rough, and one of the founders, Aaron Elmore, is here.
Afternoon.
Hello. You have a play that's going on.
That's right. We have two more weekends of the Ladies of the Camellias. We have a performance tomorrow night and Thursday night, and we'll be running it Friday and Saturday in the evening at 7:30, Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 7:30, and then Sunday at 2 o'clock we have a matinee. And we'll do the same thing next weekend.
So this is the sort of the middle of your run.
That's right.
And are you still enthused about the play?
Oh, my gracious. Yeah, well, it plays always grow over time, and they get richer, and the performances vary somewhat. Actually, we worked with, for many years, Ed Christian, one of the most workingest men in show business. He's moved on to bigger pastures here, but he was always fond of saying that he felt like shows tend to wander as much as they improve, which in some cases is true. I would say that this one is definitely improved. And, of course, most of the time with our shows, Katie and I tend to be fairly close to the action all the way up to the end. And so, although we do let some things rest, we also tinker with them and improve some things, and we're also there to make sure they don't wander too far off the rails. So it's definitely it's gotten better as it's seen more people and has been seen by more people.
Sure, because once you're on stage, I think you've said, you can see who's in the audience.
Absolutely.
And certainly you hear the response.
Yes, and with a comedy, of course, the response is enormously key to how things go along and how fast we get through the evening, etc. This comedy elicits a tremendous response, and the audiences have been delightful. So,
excellent. Sounds like a delight. You said a delightful play, which is a good thing to think about as November comes and gets darker.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
and you have that one sentence summary of the plot.
Yes.
I want to hear that again.
Okay. This is a play about two divas and a Russian anarchist kind of cooped up together in a theater in Paris in 1898. The two divas are Sarah Bernhardt of the Divine Sarah. Many people have heard of her, mostly because she spent a tremendous amount of energy promoting herself back when she was alive. And the other is Eleonora Duza, who back in the day was every bit as famous, I think, as Sarah, although she's from Italy. So two great European theater giants. And, of course, theater giants back in the late 1800s, generally speaking, were the ones in charge of the whole thing. Their money was what had paid for the theater. They were the ones who decided who wore what. They decided what the repertoire was going to be. And generally starred in their company, in their productions, and almost always people were coming to the theater to a greater or lesser extent to see them in whatever it was they were going to play. There wasn't a lot of, I wouldn't say, theatrical kind of experimentation. It was a lot more about making sure that you got your audience coming back to see you in things they liked or to see you in new work, and then you might let that go if it didn't go so well, or you might bring it back in a couple of years. So they had a repertory of, oh gosh, it's impossible to say. I'm sure it was close to 20 or 30 or 50 plays that she did probably during her lifetime and performed many of them many, many times. And Duza did the same thing. Duza was born into a theater family, so she started out right as a young person in front of audiences and touring, which is not an easy sort of life. We all get very used to our home being around us, those of us who are lucky enough to have homes to have around us, and sort of tend to pull that blanket close in ways we don't even think about. Although back in the 1800s, as is true today, you have a choice of either playing new work to the same people or playing the same work to different people. And back in the day, it made a lot more sense to them to find another audience somewhere else, in Berlin or in Buenos Aires or in New York or and truly primitive places like that.
Well, Sarah Barnhart, she came throughout the U.S.
Absolutely. She had a couple of long American tours. She went over to England, of course, very commonly. Duza did as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, everybody knew about these two women. They were household names in a time, as has been said, before there was television or, affectionately, radio.
Yes. So you're doing this play. You're going to live some of that touring artist part of this.
That's right. Yeah, it's a bit reflecting on that now. We have a chance once again to tour to Haines and in the Chilkat Center up there. And so last time we went up, we did Macbeth, which was roaring great fun with lots of battles and so forth, but it wasn't a cheery sort of a story or a cheery bunch of people. They loved it. Doesn't matter what the mood was. So I think this might charm them even more to be able to have something a little bit lighter. But we do have a little more to take with us this time. At Macbeth, there was a couple of platforms and a lot of weapons. So there's a fair bit of iron. But this time we'll have a whole set that we need to take with us, our walls and columns and couches and chairs and rugs and bits and pieces. And we've got this whole sort of environment and dressing. There's little, you know, things on the mantelpiece that never really get used. You're just there for you to enjoy and look at. So we've very rarely ever done a production in this vein where there is what's known as essentially a unit set. Is there the play was certainly unheard of in Shakespeare's whole lexicon or outlook, but to do a play where it starts at a certain point in time and the actual events of the play finish, you know, whatever, 3 hours later or 2 hours later. This play does that. It aligns itself with what the Greeks would call the unities, and the unity of time being one of those things. They thought that plays, at the best, well, some of the more opinionated Greeks who actually got their work hung on to over the last thousands of years, thought that you shouldn't do a play if it was bouncing all over the world. That was just too confusing for the audience. You should be set in one place. I bet you there were playwrights. The only reason rules like that ever got made is because somebody was trying to do it and thought it was cool. So I'm sure these things have been done all over the world at every single opportunity and every time. But this one happens to obey the unities. It takes about 2 hours plus a 15-minute intermission to play, and the events of the play take about 2 hours. So.
Well, that's quite different than a Shakespearean play.
It's quite different. Well, Shakespeare takes you to France and back to England and up to Scotland and everywhere you like. Yeah,
everywhere. Yeah.
And you're never really sure, often in the Shakespeare play, how long the events take. You know, there's been many acres of, many running feet of books written about how long does it take to play Hamlet. What actually is the length of time? Is it months? Is it years? Is it a few days? There's, you know, some of them you think they're impossibly compressed, like the events in Othello. Of course, there's some events in Italy, but then once they arrive in Cyprus, it's like a day and a half between the happy marriage just going completely to pieces and everybody ending up dead. What a great thing.
Well, that's what it is like in the Shakespearean
canon.
That's right.
Yeah,
this is not Shakespeare this time. It's still theater in the rough. It's people we know.
Yes.
Divas. I'm sure you cast a couple of wonderful people to be the divas.
We have incredible acting talent in this town and incredible actors that we get to work with. Katie and I, who founded Theater in the Rough now 22 years ago, are actors ourselves, and we enjoy that particular part of the art form itself, although I don't think there's a single part of the theater form that we dislike particularly. It's all much of a muchness. It all is incredibly important to the final product. But I think we are actors first, and I would say that if there was a way to sort of distill the whole mood down, I'd say we were an actor-driven company. So we do have some tremendous actors. And in this particular case, to have actors who are playing great actors is a kind of a daunting thing, but you can get somebody who's got the chops and who has the experience and who has a breadth of different kinds of roles, dramatic and comic, That's what you need for this, and we're very fortunate. We have Katie Jensen, who's playing Sarah Bernhardt, and then Donnie Scott is playing Eleanor Duza. I just read in Donnie's bio, and you learn these things about people by reading their bios in your own program. This is her 21st show with us, which is a tremendous, great bunch of experience that she's brought to this theater of ours, which is theater of hers, too. I mean, it's really it's a community.
Sure. And it's great fun to go and watch these people we know and, to see people in new roles. So this is called The Lady of the Camellias.
Ladies of the Camellias.
Of the Camellias. We just said there were two of them.
It's a pun on the original play, which was The Lady of the Camellias, written by Alexandre Dumas.
This play is at McPheeters Hall.
That's right.
For the month of November. And then it goes off to Haynes. What date did you have in Haynes?
14th of December we will be in Haynes. We'll travel up on the 12th and spend a day putting up our set and a day getting our production spaced out in a larger proscenium, in a much larger room, and get our volume cranked up. And then we'll be ready to perform it on the Saturday night, the 14th.
All right. Well, thank you for that detail. There are shows in the evening, and the Sunday matinees start this week.
Correct.
And where do people get tickets?
You can get them online. You can go to theaterintheroff.org as our website. You can also get them at the Jack and probably through the Jack's website. Any of the bookstores sell them to you. And they'll be available at the door.
Even at the door. Well, it's a great thing to go to on a rainy night or even a clear night. It's The Ladies of the Camellias at McPheeters Hall with our own Theater in the Rough.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 13th of November, 2013. It's the birthday of St. Augustine, born in what is now Algeria in the year 354. St. Augustine believed in original sin and used himself as an example by writing his Confessions, one of the first memoirs of Western literature. The World Wide Web is 23 years old today. The proposal for a new global system of interlinked documents on the Internet, published on this date in 1990. Tim Berners-Lee, a British computer scientist, and Robert Kalow wrote the proposal, including a prototype web page, which was nothing fancy, no pop-up ads, no social media, no emoticons, no funny cat videos. The sentence at the top of the page said, "The World Wide Web is a wide-area hypermedia information retrieval initiative aiming to give universal access to a large universe of documents." The web became available for use by the public in August 1991. The science fiction author Arthur C. Clarke had predicted it in a 1970 issue of Popular Science. He wrote that satellites would, quote, "bring the accumulated knowledge of the world to your fingertips, and people would access this through a machine that was a combination of computer, telephone, television, and photocopier, and it would deliver to a person all the information he needs for his everyday life." It's the birthday of Robert Louis Stevenson, born in Edinburgh, 1850, dropped out of school where he was studying engineering, and became a bohemian, hanging out with seamen and thieves and chimney sweeps. He wanted to live a life of adventure and sail the high seas, but his very poor health forced him to move to France, where the weather was supposed to be better, and where he met an American woman, Fanny Osborne, and when she traveled back to the United States, he followed her all the way to San Francisco and finally married her there. They traveled constantly, looking for a climate to improve his health. They tried Switzerland, Scotland, France, England, New Jersey, finally wound up on the Pacific island of Samoa. Stevenson's health kept failing, but he wrote constantly, on trains, in boats, in his bed. One day in the summer of 1881, he painted a map of an imaginary island for his stepson, and the map gave him an idea for the novel Treasure Island. He finished it in a few weeks, and the book would become one of the most popular adventure stories of all time, starring the one-legged pirate Long John Silver. A few years later, he wrote The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll, and Mr. Hyde wrote it in a single week. Stevenson's contemporaries saw him as one of the great writers of his generation. Henry James considered him an equal, but critics began to look down on him as a children's writer of adventure stories. Except for the writer Jorge Luis Borges, who said, "If you don't like Stevenson, there must be something wrong with you." Here's a poem for today by Krista Lucas, entitled "Morning." The stillness, the radio's news, the scent of rain, my neighbor bending to pick up his newspaper in its orange plastic bag tossed on the step, the cars all heading this way or that, a fine spray beneath their wheels, vapor rising from sidewalks, and the light of the eastern sun slanting long as if there's all the time in the world. Morning, a poem by Krista Lucas from her collection Fans of My Unconscious, published by the Black Rock Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. My name's Ann Fuller. Hello, Shasha, and welcome.
Hi.
Welcome to our interview show. I understand that you're coming to Juno to do both workshops and a performance. Is that right?
Exactly. Next week. Well, we're leaving tomorrow for Ketchikan, and then we're heading to you.
That's
afterward.
One. Great. Have you visited Alaska before?
My father went on a cruise after my mom passed away. We went up there. But I hate that way of going.
It can be great to take a quick trip to Alaska for the first time and then figure out how to come back and and enjoy it more thoroughly. So no problem there.
Actually, I had a fan that was living up in Ketchikan, and she kept saying, "You've got to come, you've got to come." And then there was another group of people that for the last 15 years, they said, "You have to come up here."
Well, so. Yes. But now, as I understand, we've had wearable art, and you've taken this, it's sculpture, it's textile art, and then you perform with it. And I'd like to hear more about movement imagery.
Oh, well, that's what we'll be doing in the workshops, while they're making things and letting things dry, because the mind always has more things of what it can fantasize than we have time to make almost. Because if you work with movement, you can start to visualize. You know, if you're doing it for a while, I just help people visualize things that they're making in the air with their arms, because I when I make my costumes, they're like they're as if I was drawing imagery off the body. That's how it originally came to life, was I was drawing, making drawings, but I always use the human body as a base from which to build. You know, even if it was like the unseen energy around the body, or if it was just fantasy of wings. I just try to express it, because that's what I had, the best tool I had was my own body.
Right. And now you've been doing this for quite a while, and I love the description from the poster. It says, "Exquisite and ephemeral body sculpture."
And
yeah, because I was making sculptures originally, but I wanted them to move and come to life. They had to be like a tool. They had to have a life of their own, a time when they were ignited. You know.
Ah, now that's fascinating to me. Here in Southeast Alaska, people from the native cultures have talked about how important it is to see when an object, a particular heirloom rattle or a fine blanket robe, is danced. And the way it comes, the phrasing is quite peculiar to that, that it's the, did you see when the rattle was danced? And so I find an echo of that in your talking about how important body and art and then the whole imagination that gets added. So tell me about these two workshop sessions. Are you expecting to have really skilled artists coming?
No. No, it can be for anyone. Or it can be for a skilled artist, either way. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if they have parents asked, because we all can tap into, because we'll be casting, let's see, I think one of them is creating a mask.
Yes.
And then I work with movement while it's drying,
mm-hmm.
sort of kind of give people an idea where they could go from that.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then they can ornament it and paint it. There's two a day between each workshop. I think the other one is a lantern. I'm not sure.
Yeah, they have called it here Wire Forms in Light. That's the Tuesday evening workshop. And ornamented rice paper balls.
We're hoping people can take both, because then they would, the first day they'd, you know, they cast a mask, and then the next day, or they build onto it, and then the next day they would add a headdress form to it.
Ah.
Or that headdress form can just be a sculpture if you don't take the first workshop. You know, it would just be a sculpture that you'd put a little candle in that you would then move in the space.
Yes.
I don't know if we can darken it that day, but we can get an idea.
Thank you. And I wanted to make sure that I said that these workshops, which are at our Jack, the Arts Cultural Center, is half price for wearable art artists.
And you can wear them to the performance and bring everything to the performance. And please bring a little cat bell if you happen to have one.
A special note, because Shasha is performing on Wednesday the 20th, that's 7:30 at the Jack, and that will be a wonderful time to see your imagination, Shasha, on display to us. And now, make that offer for the audience again. Tell me what they're supposed to bring.
Well, first of all, the people from the workshop, we would love to have them come and sit in the audience with their donned headdresses, mm-hmm. sculptures, and I have a few cat bells, like little bells, that I'm bringing, but I can't bring enough. So if you happen to have a little tiny bell, nothing else, but people, I have my audience kind of respond very gently to my movements on the stage, so they're part of integrated back and forth with me. So it's just little bells.
Little bells. Well, thank
yeah.
you. That's a great thing to know. And these workshops, the two workshops are Monday evening, Tuesday evening. The performance is Wednesday evening, next week, all at the Jack downtown. And we are speaking with Shasha Higby, and she has a website, and there's a beautiful poster out. There's information on the Jack website. And so those are the exact details. Oh, and I wanted to also mention that wearable art, the exhibit of Juno Productions of Wearable Art, happens in February. And this year the theme is Technicolor. And there's also going on right now, signing up if you want to be an artist with wearable art or to bid on the best table at the performance of wearable art. So even though our own wearable art isn't until February, this in November is a great thing to get started with.
This is to trigger the whole thing, help you get moving with your thoughts and ideas. So,
well, this is wonderful, Sasha, and I wonder if there's anything else you want to tell us. What are you doing in Ketchikan?
There is a performance and a move lanterns in light at a workshop. They only have time for one. I'm hoping the people here will have a time chance midday to work on their work, because it's two workshops separate from the other. But no, it's a performance and a workshop.
Oh, well, I for one would like to say that I'm really glad that we persuaded you to come on up and give us this encouragement. The description of the sheer imagination and enthusiasm you have for this work of body sculpture and illuminating body movement is just fascinating.
And there's puppets and little tiny things as well, and every part of the body is illuminated. Finger puppets,
Well, thank you very much, Sasha, and we look forward. And
the website, shashahigby.com, you got that, right?
Okay, yes, that's the website for this wonderful artist who's coming to Juneau. And wearable art and the JAHC website here in Juneau have a few more details. So I think that finishes this up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
Look
very much.
Look forward to coming up, meeting everybody. Bye.
It'll be great to have you.
Okay, bye.
Back through the years, I go wandering once again. Back to the seasons of my youth, I recall a box of rags that someone gave us, and how my mama put the rags to use. There were rags of many colors, but every piece was small, and I didn't have a coat, and it was way down in the fall. Mama sewed the rags together, so in every piece with love, she made my coat of many colors that I was so proud of. As she sewed, she told a story from the Bible she had read about a coat of many colors Joseph wore, and then she said, perhaps this coat will bring you good luck and happiness. And I just couldn't wait to wear it, and Mama blessed it with a kiss. My coat of many colors that my mama made for me, made only from rags, but I wore it so proudly. Although we had no money, why was rich as I could be, in my coat of many colors my mama made for me.
Good afternoon. It's 3:30 here in the Juneau Afternoon Studio. My name's Ann Fuller. Tonight is a Wildlife Wednesday, and we have guests here in the studio, Kathy Hawker, nature artist, and the organizer, Patricia Wherry. And so, Patricia, can you tell us what the program is called tonight?
Well, this is her title, Kathy Hawker's title, and she's calling it Drawing from Nature, Wild Things from a Sketcher's Eye.
Excellent. And where is it?
We're doing a new venue, Thunder Mountain High School, in the library. And for people who don't know where Thunder Mountain is, they want to use the first stoplight, turn left past the Valley Racquet Center. That'll
okay.
help them find it.
And that'll help you find the high school and the library. And so what time does it start?
7 to 8.
Okay, so 7 o'clock tonight. And then, hello, Kathy.
Hi, Ann.
This is my neighbor.
Neighbor.
Oh. But also people who, I want to know more. You are going to give a presentation on drawing through nature.
Yeah.
nature right here or from other places?
It's actually everywhere from Juneau to Europe to Chile. We've got images on there. I'm going to take people on a tour through my sketchbooks on a tour through some illustrations tonight just to kind of see what I've seen and hear a bit about some things that I've learned and some things I wish I hadn't learned, perhaps, but mostly things that I've enjoyed.
I see. And so you've been an observer, and do you carry a sketchbook with you most of the time?
I often don't carry a sketchbook for weeks, but wish I had one with me, which is why I've developed some techniques for drawing from memory, which I'll talk a bit about tonight, and they're things that anybody can do. I don't always have a sketchbook, but sometimes I'll get into a spate and carry them all the time.
I see. And I think I've seen some of your illustrations where you start with a sketch and yet have comments or little pull-out details.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to me a wonderful technique for pointing out what it was that attracted your attention to the creature. Do you do mostly creatures or do you do plants?
Oh, that's a great question. Actually, when I got asked to do the Wildlife Wednesday, I was really thrilled and excited to do it. So thank you, Patricia. So I immediately said yes. And then I thought, wow, do I have a lot of wildlife sketches to show? I actually love drawing plants.
Ah.
And so I have a lot of plant sketches. But as I went back through my sketchbooks, because I've been doing this for, almost 20 years now, I was able to pull out quite a bit of wildlife. That is, you have to stretch your definition from wildlife as the furry and the cute to wildlife as maybe the squishy and the small or the slightly scary and the creepy.
Oh, now this sounds like a wide-ranging program. We've got geographical variety and now everything from cute to squishy.
Exactly. Oh, that's perfect.
Oh, I like that. Cute to squishy. And now, I am intrigued with the difference between a page of your sketchbook, a page that you've kept from your sketchbook, and an illustration.
Oh, you're asking all the right questions. And actually, because that's actually kind of the two parts of the talk I'm going to do. Oh. I'm going to start with sketches, because that's really kind of what's dear to my heart. But illustration is important to me, too. And it's a bit of a different process. It borrows from the sketching, borrows aspects from the sketching. Sketching informs it, but it's a different thing. It's often a lot more challenging. So I'll be talking about both.
Okay. So a sketch implies to me maybe a quickness?
Yeah, it often does. And in my case, in this case, for the purposes tonight, sketches are drawings done directly from observation. So there's no manipulation of what's going on in the image. Illustrations, the illustration tells a story with an image, and so you usually have to manipulate what you see in an illustration to more accurately tell the story. So it requires it's more challenging in that. You have to move things. You can't just rely on something you see. You have to arrange things, and that can make it a little more difficult.
So this is a great chance to find out about everything from sketchbooks through finished illustrations. And when you say move things, what flashed in my mind was I once took a photograph with a camera of a great mountain. It was a snow-covered mountain. And, of course, when I got it back, all I could see was the three bright colors on the trash can in the foreground of the mountain. But on the print, it took up, 30% of the height of the mountain, and it definitely attracted the eye. It was much brighter. And I didn't compose the picture because our eyes and how we interpret scenes, we are so good at focusing on what's interesting or looking at two sides and remembering what we've seen. And if you just transfer it to two dimensions, it doesn't, as you say, convey the story as much.
Sure, and if you give it to someone else to look at, they are not going to see necessarily the same things you see. And so you have to do your very best to manipulate it so that people see what you want them to see. And even then, it may not work.
All right. So I'd like you, Patricia, to tell us just a little bit about Wildlife Wednesday. It happens every month?
We do it through the winters.
Ah.
So we try to find somebody to speak once a month through the winters months, and that might be about five or six times. And the Alaska Wildlife Alliance Southeast Chapter, which is what we are here in this part of the state, we host this.
Ah.
And it goes towards our goal of having people value creatures and see the intrinsic value in mm-hmm. just a wildlife, being wildlife.
Sure.
But then learn more specific things about them, too.
Right. And so learning about the creatures and then learning how other people have spent some time
mm-hmm.
observing and
broad range
making
of things.
Art from things. This is wonderful. So this is Wildlife Wednesday for November 13th. That's tonight. And I'm just going to say the details once more. It's at Thunder Mountain High School mm-hmm. in the valley. Go up valley, past the Racquet Club, turn into that parking lot. It's at 7 o'clock tonight. The person doing the presentation is Kathy Hawker, and hers is called Drawing from Nature, Wild Things Through a Sketcher's Eye. So I'd like to thank you both for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. This is Ann Fuller, and I have Luke Adams in the studio. And Luke is coach of the JD High School hockey team. And I understand this is the time the season starts. Is that right?
Yeah, we get going with our first home series this weekend against Soldotna.
Excellent. So we've got kids from all the way over on the Kenai Peninsula coming into Juneau to play. And now you said series, so there are several games during the weekend?
Well, we have JV and varsity games. Each team will play two games, one Friday, one Saturday. And all of our home series, we play each team twice when we bring them down.
Okay, so lots of hockey to see this weekend. That's at the Treadwell Arena.
That's right.
And I had asked if it was a men's team or a women's team, and you started to explain just now, so tell me again.
Yeah, well, we have both boys and girls on our team. We play in a predominantly boys' league, but here in Juneau, we don't have a girls' team, so we have a co-ed team, and we have some very talented young ladies that play with us.
Excellent. Do you have veterans on the high school team this year?
Sure. Yeah, we have 7 seniors and 6 juniors.
Wow.
And we have a lot of incoming freshmen and sophomores that are just moving up the ranks to play varsity this year.
Excellent. So this is a program that sounds like is popular with the kids.
Yeah, we in total we have 34 players this year, which is a lot of numbers when you look around the state and hockey teams. Some of the bigger schools may have more, but for the size of our hockey community, we have a very large participation rate.
That's excellent. So this is Juneau Douglas High School. Does Thunder Mountain have a team?
No, they do not yet. That's maybe in the works.
It could be in the works. On the other hand, you have that trade-off between where the enthusiasm is and how many and whether you would split them or not. So for now, it's the Juneau Douglas High School team. And what's the name of the league you play in?
We play in the Mid-Alaska Conference against in our conference we have Lathrop, North Pole, West Valley, and then our team. And we've been pushing each year. We're trying to get first or second in our conference so we can make it to the state tournament. That's our goal, is to reach that point.
Okay. So then this is a home series against a non-league?
Yes, this is a non-league opponent, but we've played them the past couple of years, and we're really looking to give them a run for our money. We haven't beaten them yet in our history with our varsity, but we've had a good start, and our kids are playing with a lot of confidence, so it should be a good series this weekend.
Okay, and the kind of thing where a hometown audience come cheer these kids on. How often does the team practice?
We practice. Each of our teams practices at least 3 days a week. Our varsity sometimes plays practices 4 plus 2 games, but we practice at 6 o'clock in the mornings to 7:30. So. We're usually up bright and early, and then we actually have a Monday evening practice this year as well. So, and we do some off-ice training. So our kids are very dedicated, very committed to the program, and it's really pushed us along to really start garnering some success in our program.
It sounds like a great bunch of committed people, both kids and coaches, to meet a schedule like that. Have you guys been in competition yet this season?
No, we actually, our JV team just got back from Anchorage. They went up north, and for a lot of those kids, that's a new experience just playing for their school, and they did a great job. They went 1-1-1, that's 1 win, 1 loss, 1 tie, and they made huge progress. I think their progress will be displayed when they play Soldotna this weekend. Should be fun.
Should be fun. Well, this is, it does sound like quite the event and lots of enthusiasm there. This is the first home series, and can you tell me what time the game is?
Sure. We play the JV game on Friday is at 2:15. The varsity game on Friday will be at 8 o'clock at the Treadwell Arena. And then on Saturday, the JV plays at 4 p.m., and the varsity game will start at 7 p.m.
Okay, so those are the times for this very weekend when you can watch Juneau kids fighting it out on the hockey rink.
It's a good way to put it, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of skill involved, but a lot of just drive involved managing a puck on the ice. It's a tough sport.
It is. It's very, there's a lot of things going on at once, and our kids really train a lot of different skill sets throughout, whether it's fitness or mental toughness, discipline, commitment, and on the ice, it's a cool thing to watch those kids really, really push themselves in every way.
Right, and it's physical, and then even learning plays and figuring out, and then watching how it all changes.
You bet.
When you've got other people on the ice, and then when you go up against another team, which isn't at all like scrimmaging with your own folks.
Right. You can practice the same things all the time, but the game just changes so fast. It's so dynamic that, you know, it's not, we have set ideas that we want to accomplish and set goals, but it's really a dynamic sport where the kids have to really be thinking on their feet. So it's pretty cool to watch.
Well, it sounds like it's a successful process of getting kids along, and you're getting ready for the first home series. This is Juno Douglas High School Hockey, so it'll be at the Treadwell Arena Friday afternoon, Friday night, Saturday, late afternoon and evening. Anything else to say there, Luke?
No, we just welcome everybody down to the Treadwell. We really enjoy the fan support, and we think that it's an entertaining evening for everybody, and the kids really like to see the support as well. A big thank you to all the sponsors that help us in our budgets, as well as all the other activities in June, all the community members and businesses, because without you guys, it would be much more challenging to find the competition. So welcome everybody down to watch.
All right, so that's ice hockey, the Juno Douglas High School's team against Soldotna. We've been speaking with Luke Adams, who's the coach, and good luck.
Hey, thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
The next installment of the KRNN Concert Series is coming up November 20th. Grace Elliott will host Blues by Association, Back Porch Blues and Deep Soul Grooves with some of Juno's best blues musicians, Ryland Bueller, Rob Weber, Brian Nichols, Kyle Harris, Jim White, Nick Wagner, and Eric. These shows have been selling out, so if you want tickets, be sure to get them in advance at krnn.org or the station. That's Blues by Association, Wednesday, November 20th at the Goldtown Theater at 7 p.m.
This is Bird Note. Picture yourself holding a big blue Steller's Jay. Volunteer Mark Purcell did just that while learning to net and band birds with the Puget Sound Bird Observatory. Here's Mark.
It's thrilling to see a bird that close and to feel the heat. You have complete control over this bird, and that's a unique relationship. But also, you want to protect it. It's fun to hold birds, but if there wasn't a larger purpose with the data, I wouldn't be doing this, right?
It takes days to learn how to handle a bird properly and years of practice to read its feathers and its body. You become a detective. Biologist Suzanne Tomasi knows. She's conducting the training today.
So let's just take a look at the feathers and see if we can age this bird. We have a first clue right there.
The group is learning protocols for netting and banding established by the MAPS program. MAPS stands for Monitoring Avian Productivity and Survivorship. The information banders generate by banding and recapturing the birds goes into a central U.S. database at the USGS Bird Banding Lab.
There are partnerships that involve the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There are banding stations on federal land, and they depend upon these data to look at conservation trends and use that to feed into their conservation management strategies. We want to keep common birds common.
See photos of the training at our website, birdnote.org.
This is Juno Afternoon, and this is Ann Fuller. With me right now are people from the City Museum, and to talk about Juno Trails. So welcome, Mike Blackwell. Tell me about what's going on.
Okay. Tonight is the annual meeting of the Friends of the Juno Douglas City Museum. The meeting will begin at 7 o'clock sharp in the Hangar Ballroom at the foot of Main Street. And the public is invited. The meeting is free. We'll begin with a very short business meeting in which we'll talk about some of the activities and plans of the Friends of the Museum. Then we'll have a presentation by two of Juno's distinguished naturalists, Richard Carstensen of Discovery Southeast and UAS Professor Kathy Connor. The subject will be two new books that are hitting the street, and Richard is here to talk about those books.
Thank you, Mike. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Ann.
This is Richard Carstensen, and tell me, you're going to talk about your book and Kathy's book, right?
Right.
All right. Your book I have here, Natural History of Juneau Trails.
Mm-hmm. It's basically the complete natural history of Juneau masquerading as a trails guide. And almost everyone who hikes in Juneau knows about Mary Lou King's 90 short walks around Juneau. And this is not competition for Mary Lou's guide, which was indispensable to me as I worked on this thing. That'll kind of give you the blow-by-blow and the step-by-step. This is more of a watershed approach, which is what the city actually asked us to do when they came to us in 2007 to see if we were interested in this project, is not so much the, you know, what mile on what trail you see such and such a feature, but to scale out and take a bigger view and think about the watersheds that each of these trails lies in and how those watersheds are different from each other. And
okay, so this will go with the panel signs? Such
exactly,
as I've seen
yeah.
at Gold
it's
Creek.
Part of the same project that I call the CBJ Natural History Project. Those were one of three deliverables, the trails, the trailhead signs that are now all in place.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is this publication. And then the third is a fourfold brochure to each of the 10 trail systems that you can download off the Discovery website.
Right. Well, thank you. So the book is called Natural History of Juneau Trails, A Watershed Approach, and it talks about, it has emblems for both Discovery Southeast and CBJ Parks and Recreation.
Right.
Right on the front. Inside the book, you have photographs, and I'd love to have you tell me a story about this repeat photography.
Oh yeah, that your last guest Kathy Hocker and I were involved in that in 2004 and 2005 on contract with the Forest Service. We did a project where we first selected several hundred old photographs that looked like they had high potential to teach us about change when we went out there and actually retook them. A lot of them were on the ground, but quite a few of them were in the air, too. Like the photographs that the Navy took in the 1920s, we got up in planes and we retook some of those and learned a lot about how things change over time. And I've used that ever since in almost every project I'm involved in, and there's a lot of it in the CBJ Trails project, too.
Yes, it's just fascinating to find a photo that was taken and then go and take it again. See what it looks like today. So this was one book. And then the other book is also a discovery guide. It's Reading Southeast Alaska's Landscape.
Yeah, Mike, why don't you tell a little about how that idea hatched?
It started with Kathy Connor, and she's one of the contributors, chiefly with technical advice and review and general guidance. And it started, and then we found Richard.
Yes.
And over a period of a couple of years, it blossomed. And
now we have this wonderful book. So the authors are going to be at the Friends of the City Museum annual meeting. And we're here today to tell people that that meeting is tonight.
Tonight.
At the Hangar Ballroom downtown. Starts at 7 o'clock. Everyone's invited.
And one other important point. Folks who join or renew with the Friends of the Museum at the $75 level, now or forever, get a free copy of the Trails Guide.
All right. Thank you very much. You're listening to K2FM. In Juneau, we rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K29AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201AM in Gustavus, KT20BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. Also on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. You can find us on the World Wide Web. The weather is going to be getting a little colder and then a little clearer. This has been Juneau Afternoon. And this has been Ann Fuller.